This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama. Dozens of people lined up outside the Supreme Court yesterday ahead of today's hearing, one that affects hundreds of thousands of young people brought to the U.S. as children. At issue is DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. The Obama administration established the program by executive order back in 2012. It gives undocumented immigrants who came to the U.S. as children the legal right to work and study here. Nearly a million young people have relied on this program to remain in this country for the past 7 years. The Trump administration has been trying to end DACA for more than 2 years, and that fight is now before the U.S. Supreme Court. Joining us from Capitol Hill to discuss the latest is Michael Shear, a White House reporter for The New York Times and co-author of Border Wars: Inside Trump's Assault on Immigration. Michael, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Here with us in studio at WBHM is Isabel Rubio, Executive Director of the Hispanic Interest Coalition of Alabama. Isabel, welcome.
Good morning. Hello. Thank you for having me.
We also welcome your questions and thoughts about DACA, especially if the program affects you directly. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Michael, let's back all the way up and just remind us how we arrived at this Supreme Court hearing on DACA. The Trump administration has been planning to end this program since almost 2 years ago, like September 2017, right?
Right. Actually, it goes back further if you want to. The president, President Trump, had sort of said during the campaign when he was running for office that he thought that this program that President Obama had put in place to protect these young people was unconstitutional. And so there was a real sense that it was threatened even before he came into office. At the same time, he also expressed sympathy for the what he called the young kids. He said he had them in his heart, and that they that he wanted to find a way to protect them. And so there were these conflicting impulses that that played out inside his administration, hardliners fighting with folks who were more sympathetic to the Dreamers. But ultimately, it was the hardliners that won out. They pushed the president into ending it on September 5th. They announced September 5th of 2017, announced that the program would end. It would have a six-month kind of wind-down period, and that after that, it would be no more, and people would potentially be subject to deportation if Congress hadn't acted. Of course, the courts intervened. The program got continued. The courts essentially ordered the administration to keep running the program. Efforts to deal with it legislatively collapsed several times. And here we are at the Supreme Court, which is going to decide whether or not the president's decision to end the program was appropriate or not.
Here's a clip from former U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions back in 2017 announcing that the administration intended to end DACA. Here's part of what Jeff Sessions said.
The program known as DACA that was effectuated under the Obama administration is being rescinded. The DACA program was implemented in 2012 and essentially provided a legal status for recipients for a renewable two-year term, worker authorization, and other benefits. The policy was implemented unilaterally to great controversy and legal concern after Congress rejected legislative proposals to extend similar benefits on numerous occasions to this same group of illegal aliens. In other words, the executive branch, through DACA, deliberately sought to achieve what the legislative branch specifically refused to authorize on multiple occasions.
That's former Attorney General Jeff Sessions speaking in 2017. So, Michael, the administration's argument for ending the program is that DACA was unlawful by its nature. What's the counter-argument, Ben?
Well, so the interesting thing is that the issue at the court is maybe not the sexiest of issues, right? The issue at the court really is not the substantive, merits on one side or the other of the program. It's really, did the administration follow the rules that they needed to follow in order to end it? Had the administration argued in ending the program, here's the policy reasons why we don't think the program is good. We don't think these are deserving individuals, or we think that these individuals pose a threat to the United States, either economically or in other ways, then the court probably would have given great deference to the fact that the administration can certainly reverse a policy that was put in place before. Instead, all that the administration really argued was the point that Jeff Sessions just made in that speech, which was it's unconstitutional, it was an executive overreach and should be declared by the court to be kind of unlawful. Basically, that's the question in front of the court. Did they do it the right way? The people on the other side, the plaintiffs, are arguing, look, the administration didn't give any decent reason to end this program, and so in light of that, the program should be left alone.
Isabel, let me play a quick clip from one of our DACA recipients. Here's what Wendy left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Wendy. I'm from Fort Wayne, Indiana. I am a dreamer. I've been a DACA recipient since 2013. It has helped me through college, even though I don't get financial aid, and a lot of people don't know that we don't get government assistance, but I am still able to work for it and pay it out of pocket. It has helped me get a car, and it has helped me start a credit line, so later in the future, you know, I can apply for a mortgage loan, which is great because this is something that I was unable to do. And I am thankful for this program, and I hope that soon there's a better solution.
Wendy, thank you for sharing your story with us. Isabel, what kinds of stories have you heard here in Alabama in terms of the impact of DACA?
The story that we've just heard is the same story that I've heard hundreds and hundreds of times of young people who have been able to take advantage of this benefit. I mean, we've got young folks here that, you know, are like all of our kids, working and trying to better themselves. And the most important thing that we need to lift up is that, you know, 90% of the DACA kids that we've got are working. We have got almost more than half of them are in school. And so this is a really important program, not just for the immigrants that get the benefit, but for the people who employ them.
Are there any particular concerns that folks here are most worried about if DACA is rescinded?
Well, I mean, everybody worries about what's going to happen to me. What does that mean? You know, so many of the young people that we come into contact with have lived in this country their entire lives, have really no recollection of the country from which they came. And so it's really like sending somebody, it would be if they had to leave, sending somebody to, you know, a foreign country.
Let's play another clip from a DACA advocate, Maria, about what it takes to reapply and how stressful that can be. Here's what Maria had to say.
My name is Maria, and I live in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. I am an advocate for the undocumented and have been doing it for 16 years. Part of my advocacy has involved helping the DACA kids come up with the funds of $480 for the process of fingerprinting and everything else that Homeland Security asks for. These children are now afraid that DACA will be revoked, and then they'll be in limbo. Right now, they're living in limbo, and they're afraid that Homeland Security will come after them if it gets revoked, and their whole families will be deported. It's a sad time for our nation. It's a sad time for me, being a Latina, living in the United States of America.
Yeah, Maria, thank you very much for sharing your story from Camp Hill. That's just near Harrisburg, by the way, just on the other side of the Susquehanna River. How much of what Maria described, Isabel, sounds familiar in terms of the process of DACA renewal here?
Everything sounds totally familiar and the same. At our office, we do actually do DACA renewals. Of course, we did the initial DACA when we could. So far this year, we have done 184 renewals. And, you know, it's every time somebody comes up for the renewal, it's just a question of how long am I going to be able to have this? First of all, though, can I even get the funds to do it? Because there are the USCIS fees that just mentioned.
The Citizenship and Immigration Services.
Yes, Citizenship and Immigration Services. And then there are also fees that attorneys charge. We have a program where we charge very nominal fees and none if folks can't pay for them. But, you know, it really is people's lives are in limbo. Even when you have your DACA, it's still a question of, is this going to be revoked? And that's something that, you know, we live and they live every day on pins and needles, wondering, is today the day that we're going to get this news?
Michael, I just want to make sure I understand legally what we're walking into with the Supreme Court. It seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like the lower courts were basically saying that the Trump administration wasn't really making an argument. They were just saying DACA is unconstitutional, but they didn't really have much of a framework as to why. Am I hearing that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, my colleague Julie Davis and I, when we wrote our book that you mentioned at the top, did a lot of reporting into why this came to be. And it turned out that the person who needed to write the memo to rescind DACA was a woman by the name of Elaine Duke, who was then the acting Secretary of Homeland Security. She resisted putting her name on a memo that would say all sorts of kind of anti-immigrant things about the DACA recipients. She was sympathetic to the DACA recipients, and despite pressure from Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General at the time, and Stephen Miller, the president's top immigration advisor, to put all sorts of things in the memo that said, this program would encourage waves of illegal immigration, that the people that were in the program were potential threats to the country. She refused to put all of that in the memo. The only thing she would put in the memo was the legal argument that said this is unconstitutional. And that really weakened the government's case. And so, without kind of boring the audience at all, the issue in front of the court is something called the Administrative Procedures Act, which lays out how and the process by which the government can change policy. Right. And so the question is,
Michael,
did
sit tight on that just one
correctly?
Second. I want to hear more about that on the other side of this pause. We'll continue in a minute with Michael Shear of The New York Times and Isabel Rubio of the Hispanic Interest Coalition of Alabama. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Birmingham, Alabama. We are broadcasting live at WBHM for 1A Across America, our special collaboration with six stations to hear what issues matter to you as we get closer to the elections. We are discussing DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, with New York Times White House reporter Michael Shear and Isabel Rubio of the Hispanic Interest Coalition of Alabama. We'd love to hear from you, too, your questions about DACA or how you have seen its effects where you are. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Before we keep going, Michael, I'm sorry, I had to cut you short before. Let me let you finish your thought, and then we'll keep going.
Well, no, I was just saying that's the ultimate question before the court today is whether or not the administration followed the right procedures. If they did, then DACA, the court will say that DACA can be ended, and that will throw it back into the political process in the courts. If they didn't follow the right procedures to end the program, then the program will survive at least until the administration makes another attempt.
There is that one piece of what Jeff Sessions said in the clip we played earlier, which is that this is not the role of the executive branch. It's the role of the legislature to deal with immigration. But immigration seems to be the issue where administrations go to die. I mean, administration after administration after administration has said, we're going to get it done, and no one seems to be able to get it done. How does DACA fit into this larger quagmire of immigration reform?
That is very true. It's been a divisive issue for a long time. There's been many attempts over the last, say, 15 or 20 years to try to come to some sort of consensus. Usually the way that attempt has been made has been to say, we're going to do a comprehensive reform so that everybody gets a little bit of what they want. And DACA has usually been one piece of that. It's been one, a part of the puzzle that folks have said, if everybody else can get what they want, then perhaps the DACA recipients known as Dreamers can ultimately be given a permanent solution and a path to citizenship. The problem is that those sort of overall large efforts to compromise not only failed before, but I think have been doomed to even more failure now that President Trump has come into office and really taken a different approach, really taken a really hardline approach on these immigration policies, which has really divided and polarized the politics in Washington so that there's a lot less trust between the Democrats and the Republicans and the administration that would have to happen in order for some kind of bigger solution to the immigration problem to come to fruition.
Yeah, citizenship has come up in a number of comments from our listeners, including from Kelly. Kelly emailed, I know a school teacher who has been here for more than 20 years and another has been here for 17. If they applied for citizenship, surely they would have gotten citizenship by now and wouldn't have all these worries. And one listener asked, why is getting citizenship not an option? Am I missing something? Michael, I think the reason it's not an option is because the law doesn't allow for it. DACA is not designed to be part of a path to citizenship. Is that right?
Right. I mean, the law lays out a series of things that have to happen for somebody who's an immigrant to the country in order to apply for citizenship. You have to get a green card first. There are certain procedures that you have to go through in order to get a green card on the path to citizenship. And one of the things that prevents you from doing that is coming here illegally or being in the country illegally. And, you know, that's the position that most of these DACA recipients find themselves in, usually not their own fault, right? I mean, the reason they're more sympathetic group than maybe other immigrants who are undocumented is that, you know, if you're 6 years old and you were brought here by your parents, you really didn't have a lot of agency to decide, you know, I'm going to cross the border illegally. And yet here you are, and you don't have the legal option to even be here permanently in a legal status or to pursue citizenship. So it's not an option for them. And that's ultimately what this whole struggle has been about, is what is the ultimate permanent solution for these very sympathetic immigrants?
Isabel?
Yeah, I just wanted to pipe in on that question because, you know, what I have learned over the years in doing this work is that the general public is basically pretty ignorant about the immigration system and what it takes to get here to this country. And our immigration system over the years has been shaped to favor different countries in terms of visa allocations and that sort of thing, instead of really looking at the real need. And to, you know, for most people to become a citizen, it takes, you know, 7 to 10 years. For that process to happen. And for certain other countries, Mexico being one of them, it can take over 25 years to just get your visa to be able to join your family member in this country. So, I mean, it's a whole other conversation, but it points to the fact that our immigration system is horribly out of date and terribly misunderstood by even smart people who just don't make this their life's work.
We also heard from a former college admissions employee about the difficulties that DACA students face on college campuses. Here is what Natalie left in our inbox.
Hello, this is Natalie from Fayetteville, North Carolina. I'm calling about my firsthand experience with seeing the effect of DACA. I used to be an admissions specialist at the University of Arizona, which is certainly an area in Tucson with a number of Dreamers in the population. One of the unfair aspects for the Dreamers that were in those high schools was they were among the ranks of, you know, full American citizens, but they had to apply as an international student. International students have a harder time gaining admission, their tuition is much higher, and they are not eligible for any freshman scholarships. It's a small piece of the puzzle, but it seemed to really have a great impact on those students not feeling like they belonged.
Natalie, I appreciate you calling in. And Isabel, you know, it may be a small piece of the puzzle in some cases. I know there are certain university systems in California, for example, they had a long conversation as to whether they were going to treat DACA recipients like in-state students for purposes of tuition. The regents of the University of California are one of the complainants in the Supreme Court case today. The NAACP is another. So I know there are some university systems that have kind of done battle over this. Are the young people that you deal with mostly college bound? Are they mostly looking for, you know, blue collar careers? Like, how do they envision their future, Isabel, if they could stay?
People envision their future many different ways, but so many kids that I talk to are so interested in pursuing professional careers. You know, we need these kids in jobs of teachers and nurses and doctors, engineers, lawyers, all of the professions that we get called all the time, Joshua, for folks looking for great bilingual candidates. And here they are. I mean, we have got folks who are just really trying to realize their dreams and aspirations. And I think that when you create a space that is full of opportunity, people are going for the brass ring, and that's what I see. But when you deal with university systems that don't provide opportunities for kids to go at an in-state rate in a state that they've lived in all their years, that really does become an obstacle. And so we work with the kids and their families to try and help make college affordable, but it's still a big challenge.
There are folks, Isabel, who say, I'm totally sympathetic to these kids, and I know they're working hard, and I know they're busting their tails to try to, you know, be good citizens and work hard and stay out of trouble and study hard. But the law is the law, and this has to go through Congress. And if we allow people to bend the law in this case, then the law is meaningless. And then we just have another set of problems with immigration reform. That I sympathize with these young people, but we got to have rule of law. What would you say to them?
Right. So I say that the law isn't always right. You know, I mean, sometimes we have to change a law. And that's what happened when we think about the civil rights era. You know, we just because laws are on the books doesn't mean they meet the current social need in our society. And we're not talking about criminal issues here. We're talking about just laws that are outdated and don't reflect the need in this country. And I think that, you know, for lots of reasons, immigration has become this really, really divisive and hot button issue. And our current president is using it, you know, to the fullest extent of his ability and his platform to continue to promote fear. When we are in a strong economic position in this country where we need the labor force that immigrants provide, and we need the opportunity for these kids to realize their dreams and aspirations to continue to contribute the way that we want them to in our economy and in our society.
Michael, what's the timeline look like from here? We've got oral arguments today. The Supreme Court will probably, I imagine they're not going to rule this year on this. They're probably going to take a little more time. And then in the meantime, immigration reform remains a gigantic open question. One of our listeners, Ashley, did ask if there's any legislation in the House or Senate that would permanently address the issue. None that I know of. But what do you see? What does this look like going forward?
Right. So I think what we fully expect in the court is that the court will probably be one of the marquee decisions in the court's term. That term usually ends in late June of next year. It's likely, I think, that this would be a decision that would come right at the very end. So in late June, of course, that's right at the height of the beginning of the general election campaign for 2020 for president. So you can imagine this will inject that this issue pretty directly into the political process. As far as the legislative outlook, I think, you know, most people think that after the multiple attempts to address DACA over the last 2 years, that until the court decides, we're sort of in a legislative limbo. There's not going to be a lot of pressure on anybody to actually make a decision on either side legislatively until we know what the court rules. So, you know, there are some, the Democrats in the House have put through some legislation that would essentially a DREAM Act that would permanently give these folks protection and give them a path to citizenship. That's not going anywhere in the Republican Senate at the moment. And I think, you know, we're essentially, the legislative process is in the same limbo that the DACA recipients are in, is that until the court makes a decision, I think everything's kind of frozen.
And before we move on, Isabel, you told me that there is a local DACA recipient who's at the Supreme Court today, right?
She is. She's been a great activist in this movement and is a current law student and is there today testifying. And we're so, so proud of her.
Tell us a little bit about her.
So
if insofar as you're comfortable, I know that some of that information may be sensitive, but what can you tell us about her?
Well, just that she's lived here, of course, like so many other young kids for most of her life. Her parents were restaurant owners and, you know, worked hard to send her to Catholic school. And she came to college here in Birmingham and, you know, really got involved in the movement at that time. And her parents had sort of kept her sheltered. But once she sort of saw and after HB 56 here in Alabama and everything with the DACA kids, she said, you know, I'm not going to sit down. I've got to speak up and be active. And
I'm sorry, so, HB 56?
Well, that's was a state law that was the worst anti-immigration law in the country back in 2011. But at any rate, so she has, you know, graduated with very top of her class here in town, and then has gone to law school and has got a great deal. You know, she was got scholarships to go to law school, and now she's today at the Supreme Court, and we couldn't be more proud of her and her agency and what she's been able to do.
Well, we will see what the agency of these young people will mean, how the Supreme Court will regard their arguments and the government's arguments as these cases move forward. Isabel Rubio is the executive director of the Hispanic Interest Coalition of Alabama. Isabel, thanks for talking to us.
Joshua, it's been great fun. Thank you.
And Michael Shears is a White House reporter for The New York Times and co-author of Border Wars, Inside Trump's Assault on Immigration. Michael, thank you.
Thanks for having me.